Danielle, it's, we don't wait for PhDs more than 15 minutes. We're not going to wait for these clowns, so. We're going to call to order the Judiciary Committee of the House at 1:32 on the 9th of February. We have to consider today HCR 24, support against the suit for the suit against the federal government by the state, HCR 28 and HB 277. The first bill for consideration is HCR 24. We have Mel with us to give us the sponsor's statement, and we have on the line Cherie Jacobus to give us their point of view, and we'll first say hello to Mel, and welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Mel Krogsing, Staff Assistant to Representative Barnes. HCR 24 puts on the public record the legislature's, or will put on the record, the legislature's strong support for the governor's decision to authorize suit against the United States government for violating the Alaska Statehood Act. When the Alaska Statehood Act was crafted, Congress guaranteed all attributes of sovereignty that were granted to all other states under the U.S. Constitution to Alaska. However, over the past few years, the terms of the compact, or Statehood Act, I should say, have been violated by the Congress. These violations include, among others, withdrawal from development of nearly 80% of the federal land from which Alaska was to derive mineral royalties. Needless to say, if this had not been done, perhaps the financial situation we see ourselves in today might not be the case. Additionally, Alaska is also the only state not allowed to sell her oil resources abroad that is specifically prohibited from doing that. We are a sovereign state, and we must not let that sovereignty be violated. The Statehood Act was an agreement between Congress and the people of the state of Alaska, and as in any other agreement, it cannot be changed unilaterally. And that's what's being done now by the federal government. They are unilaterally trying to change the Statehood Act or do things other than what was agreed upon by both parties. And we don't think that should be the case, and therefore the Speaker has introduced this resolution to just put it on the public record that the legislature strongly supports the governor's decision and that we're going to fight for Alaska's rights. And with that, I will conclude, unless you have questions, and allow Cherie Jacobus, who is our state legal expert on this subject, to give you her testimony.
Are there any questions of Mel? Seeing none, Mel, thank you very much. Cherie, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
We would say welcome, and if you could give us your name for the record and your testimony.
Yes, my name is Cherie Jacobus. I am an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law, and I am here to testify in favor of House Concurrent Resolution Number 24. The reason the Department of Law so strongly supports this resolution is several-fold. As Mel has indicated, Alaska became a state a little over 35 years ago. Two things happened when we became a state. First, we were to be admitted on equal footing with all other states, which means that there were certain sovereign rights be guaranteed to us as a state. As all of us know who have lived in Alaska for any length of time, over 35 years, many of those sovereign rights have been infringed upon. A good example is the oil export ban, as mentioned by Mel. In addition to that, we also entered into a statehood compact. A compact is a contract. It is legally enforceable, and in fact, as a compact, it has been enforced by the United States Supreme Court on many occasions. It is not unusual for a state to ask the courts to enforce the terms of that contract. In addition, we know that for the past 35 years, several terms of that contract have been violated by the federal government. There is only one way at this point, since political influence has not worked, for us to regain what we have lost over the last 35 years, and that is in the court. That is why Governor Hickel has authorized and insisted upon certain pieces of litigation being brought against the federal government in federal court. And the basis of that is to enforce the terms of that contract. I should point out that regardless of the outcome of any of these lawsuits, it is important for the people of the state of Alaska after 35 years to know exactly what it is it got at statehood. For 35 years, we've seen those statehood rights infringed upon and eroded. It is now time for us to find out what these things mean. As part of these pieces of litigation, we have, for example, the oil export ban case, which is going to be heard in federal court on March 1st. In addition, we have the compact case itself, in which we have asked the Court of Claims to enforce the terms of our contract with the federal government, in particular the 90-10 split that was guaranteed to us at statehood. It should be pointed out that this is unlike other legislation that was issued by the United States Congress. It is not simply a form of legislation. It did not become self-enacting. It only became effective after the people of the state of Alaska, at that time the territory, specifically voted on all attributes of that compact, including all of the terms, and agreed to accept the responsibilities and the burdens that reason that this administration has chosen to bring these actions in court, and it is commendable for the legislature to indicate on record that they support the governor's decision to authorize these suits against the United States government. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Thank you, Sheree. Representative Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I think this is a very good resolution. But, Sheree, I do have one question on it. In the first whereas, where you differentiate between the Statehood Compact and the Statehood Act, on the last page, where we just specify violating the Statehood Act, do we need to reiterate or clarify adding language for the Statehood Compact also?
Yes, I think that's important because, as I pointed out in my original statement, the Act itself was passed by Congress, but we did not become a state until we accepted it and created the Statehood Compact.
So if we would just amend the be it resolved portion that the state of Alaska strongly supports the decision of the governor to authorize suit against the United States government for violating the Alaska Statehood Act and the Alaska Statehood Compact. Hello?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Is that an acceptable amendment, Sheree?
Yes, that would be fine.
Okay. Good. Any other questions of Sheree? If not, Sheree, thank you very much. We don't
very much, and I appreciate you taking me in this kind of order so I can return to the conference. I should point out to the committee that I am meeting at this moment with the Solicitor General, John Leshy, and certainly are going to bring up some of these issues with him.
Good luck.
Thank you.
You have our best wishes.
Okay.
Representative Green.
Thank you. Bye.
Mr. Chairman, from the south side of the largest city in this state, I would take great pleasure in recommending unanimous and ask for unanimous concurrence to move this out of this this committee with individual recommendations.
Representative Phillips.
If the representative from the South would hold just a moment, I would like to make an amendment.
Yes.
All right. I would like to amend the second page, that line 2, to read, and the Statehood Compact, and the Alaska Statehood Compact.
We would eliminate the period after act and add and the Alaska
Statehood Compact.
Statehood Compact.
Just so there's no doubt in anybody's mind.
Very good. That is the amendment. Is there objection? Seeing none, the amendment is accepted.
I was just wondering, Mr. Chairman, if I might, if we might want to put that before, just to keep it. Keep some continuity there, since we have identified the Alaska Statehood Compact up front first and then the Act second. So leave the Act with the period behind it and insert for violating the Alaska Statehood Compact and Statehood, Alaska Statehood Act. That's just reversing the order.
Well, actually, the Statehood Act chronologically preceded the compact, so I think the order is appropriate.
I think it is true.
Yeah.
It's in a different context at that other statement.
Is there any other discussion? We have a motion to move the bill with individual recommendations. For the record, I was here in 1959, and I remember every one of these points distinctly.
Mr. Chairman.
This is very appropriate.
Mr. Chairman, if I may state for the record, too, I was here in 1959, and I know my folks voted and worked violently not for us to become a state. So.
Oh. Because they
I'll
knew
never
what was going to happen.
Right.
I think this is an age thing. I was a folk.
Well, for the record, there's some of us here at this end of the table that weren't around in 1959.
For whatever reason, we weren't here.
Is there objection?
Would that be recorded as amended?
As amended.
Yes.
Good. If not, this bill moves.
Excellent.
We have next HCR 28. Mel, I assume, is doing double duty.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. If I might, I know it's normally the sponsor makes the opening remarks, but Jerry Luckout from Legislative Legal Services is here. He has dual duty. He has to go to another committee meeting also. And I was wondering if I might just say the resolution, as I think all of you know, asks the governor to urge the attorney general to take whatever steps are necessary to either abolish, modify, whatever the Clary Partial Settlement Agreements, court orders, and decisions, and I would like to ask if Jerry Luckhout could come to the table and testify first, and then I have a few other items I'd just like to point out for you, and then I understand those will be continued at another hearing.
We try to be as accommodating as possible.
Thank you. Jerry?
Jerry, welcome.
Hi. For the record, my name is Jerry Luckhout, Legislative Counsel for the Division of Legal Services. Mr. Chairman, this resolution basically is instructing the governor to instruct the attorney general to try to get the state out of the consent decree that the state entered into in the Cleary case. Cleary was an institutional prison reform litigation was instituted by an inmate by the name of Cleary and a whole lot of other inmates back in the late 70s. And eventually the state decided to settle that litigation in the early 80s. For the most part, the law for getting out of a consent decree has been very tough, as in practically impossible. In 1992, the U.S. Supreme Court, for purposes of federal cases and federal consent decrees, loosened those purse strings or loosened the strings that tie up consent decrees quite a bit. And basically, the court was of the opinion that consent decrees, to the extent that they bind state governments and local governments, can be quite taxing and burdensome on those local governments, and that when the government officials enter into those consent decrees don't necessarily have in mind the interests of the state 20 years later, or don't know what the state's interest or what the state's concerns are going to be 20 years later. And to require the state or local government to continue to deal with the burden of that consent decree would be basically intolerable in some cases. And so the U.S. Supreme Court said, for purposes of federal law, that federal courts can open up consent decrees and basically rewrite those decrees in cases where the state can show a legitimate change of circumstances. And one of those change in circumstances that the U.S. Supreme Court basically said would seem to be a proper one was a change in the fiscal circumstances and the fiscal qualities that state had in the future. And one of those would be a lack of fiscal resources, basically, to fund that consent decree. Consent decrees for prison reform litigation were quite popular in the 70s when there was basically an explosion of prisoner suits, and the U.S. Supreme Court basically dealt with the Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment and decided that certain prison conditions were cruel and unusual. And there was an explosion of suits, and consent decrees were used a lot by the states. They didn't know how to react, I think, to a lot of the cases that were being brought. There was some concern about what the reaches of what type of conditions were allowed in prison conditions. For example, everyone for a long time believed that single celling was unconstitutional, or double celling was unconstitutional. There was a U.S. Supreme Court case that basically said that, but in a very limited case. And for purposes of one prison, that 6 by 6 foot cell, double celling was found to be cruel and unusual punishment. In a later case involving the state of Ohio, the U.S. Supreme Court said that double celling was not unconstitutional and when you had a bigger cell. But there was states sometimes were unable to really decide or really be able to predict what the U.S. Supreme Court was going to do in any particular case or what the federal courts were going to do with one of those suits. The consent decrees are very burdensome in that usually in a consent decree you're going to agree to something that is beyond the constitutional minimus, beyond the standard that you have to meet, that lowest tier. And to a certain extent, some of the things that were agreed to in Cleary are beyond what we actually have to provide as a matter of constitutional law. We are providing greater things. It's the concern of Representative Barnes, as expressed to me through Mel, that state may not be able to meet those concerns anymore. In years of declining revenues and declining production on the North Slope, we aren't as rich as we used to be. We aren't able to provide the same amount of resources in our prison system. And should we be required to still fund programs or different conditions in the prison that are not required as a matter of constitutional law? Basically, that's what this suit says. This resolution says. It doesn't, as a resolution where the legislature is expressing the legislature's will and desire, We aren't requiring anyone to do anything. But it does recognize that there is a possibility to be explored by the Attorney General's office and by the executive branch for changing the conditions that we agreed to in Cleary. There is that case law out there. It doesn't necessarily, the Alaska Supreme Court does not necessarily have to follow the U.S. Supreme Court on this issue, but it certainly is instructive as to what the Alaska courts could do, that if the U.S. Supreme Court opened up these, opened up consent decrees, it would appear that the Alaska Supreme Court might decide to do the same. And that's basically my little presentation in a nutshell. If you have any questions.
Representative Green.
As always, I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jerry, as I get the thrust of the argument here that because of declining revenues, the state's major portion of their case is going to be that we don't have the affluence we had when we made this consent decree. And yet, in a recent lease sale, it was a judge's opinion, and I think I'm at least paraphrasing, the state is swimming in money. And I'm concerned that that coupled with the fact that, you know, those people up in Alaska give money away. They give almost $1,000 a head away. Just give it away. Are those things going to counteract the fact that we aren't able now to do what we had agreed to do earlier?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, what's significant here is that the Cleary case is in a consent decree in state court. So we're going to have state court judges making these decisions instead of a federal court judge or Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals judges who believe that the state is still swimming in money because we're still giving it away to everyone. There's certainly an argument to be made in that, I think. But regardless of, you know, the truth of that, it's we in Alaska know that we do have declining oil revenues. We do know that, you as a legislature are looking at shortfalls in your budget this year, and not to mention some that are created by court decisions and some that are merely created by the price of oil dropping down to 10.
The pool level is receding.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
So, you know, we may not be able to drown in that swimming pool like we used to.
You don't think that's going to adversely affect them?
And I don't see why that would make a difference when you're dealing with state court judges in this. With federal court judges, I can understand that concern. But and the judges could always decide that we are swimming in money by looking at all the other accounts out there. If you want to look at all those extra accounts that we have and look at the permanent fund, to a certain extent we are swimming, but those monies are not necessarily available for appropriation in this instance.
Thank you.
As a matter of fact, let's see HB 58. thank you, Jerry. I see no other questions. Commissioner Pruitt is here to observe or to testify. That is option.
I have no statement, but I would certainly be willing to answer any questions people might have.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else here that wishes to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, we're certainly available for discussion on the bill, but I will tell you that it is not my intention to move this bill today. We have been asked by Dean Guinelli from the Department of Law if we would be amenable, and I indicated that we would be, to hold a executive session hearing on his presentation on Monday. He's out of town this week, unfortunately, to present the point of view of the Department of Law as regards the lawsuit, as regards the liability of the state, and that is something that is acceptable for executive sessions. So we will be holding this over until Monday for that purpose, to hear what it is that his concerns are. If there's any further discussion on the bill, we certainly can have it now. I see none. Representative Phillips?
All of my questions and comments could probably wait till then, too. So
we will obviously come out of executive session to take action, so yep. We can have the discussion at that time.
Thank you.
We're done, Mel. Thank you very much.
Thanks. That'll be on Monday.
Mr. Chairman,
that'll be the first thing on Monday.
Excuse me, if I may, I was going to just mention that I think all of you have been provided with a copy of the Cleary settlement. Your copy is blue, mine's pink. And additionally, there's just a little short list of things that are examples of the kinds of things that are over and above that might be interesting for you.
Just an observation. I wonder what the statute of limitations on these kinds of suits are. I think when I was in the service, I definitely didn't have enough space.
Yes.
I think some of your legislative staff might like to have these requirements.
I didn't get that list.
It's a little single sheet list.
In the blue book.
Just inside the cover.
Yeah,
inside
the cover
there. Okay. And finally, we have the revisit of HB 277, Identification of Public Employees. Yeah. we can. Eric, are you aware if Sue is going to be joining us? Sue Cox?
They're on their way.
We got through this quicker than they thought, huh? Well, if you don't mind standing at ease for a few minutes. Mention of the committee, we have the Department of Law, as we promised, write this bill basically with the same content, but so that it makes better sense. There was a whole lot of legalese about cross-claiming and quit-claiming and gold mining and all sorts of stuff that we've got a little more clearly laid out. We additionally, if you recall, the definition of employer for the purposes of this bill, public employer, means a state or public quasi-public corporation that excludes University of Alaska, municipal school district, or rural education attendance area. And we didn't really have a great definition for why we made that exclusion. We do now. The reason is that there is existing state law that already provides this benefit, indemnification, for those employees. Why they got it and everybody else didn't when that happened, I don't know. But that is the reason, I think, in my mind, even more justification for the fact that everybody should have this right if they have it. Representative Phillips?
Mr. Chairman, I would be concerned, however, that once we set a precedent for a definition in statute, that definition can be used in for any case?
No. The definition qualification is for the purposes of this act.
Okay. Means, let's see.
I believe that...
It doesn't say it in the definition.
Well... It says definitions in this chapter. Ba-doom, ba-doom,
okay,
ba-doom,
but ba-doom. Just because they're just because they're in the chapter doesn't mean we could be dealing with another bill somewhere else and say, hey, I remember in that chapter of the thing there's a definition for what public employee is, and it might not have anything to do with whether they're an employee of the university or.
When Cherie gets here, we'll make sure that that is done properly.
Just for this specific bill, that's fine, but we need to clarify that.
No, I tell you, I read that. Thinking that that's what it would say, and it doesn't.
No.
But we will certainly make that clear.
And we still haven't ruled
against. And there she is. Uh-oh. We did our work really expeditiously, and we got right up to...
Great.
Yeah. Thank you.
Now, is this lady related to the one that we were talking to just a little bit ago?
Same neck of the woods.
Yeah. I see.
Please. If you could, Susan, for the record, tell us who you are and
sure.
who signed your check. And we would like then if you could explain the differences in the CS as opposed to...
I'm sorry, I ran. And it's windy out. my name is Susan Cox. I'm in the Attorney General's office. I'm the supervisor of the Special Litigation Section, which defends personal injury actions against the state of Alaska and state employees. And... I don't know who signs my check. I'm a state employee. I am definitely covered by the definition in this bill. This bill has been reworked from the one you saw a week ago to hopefully, instead of having one statute that covered the whole area, we broke it down into several statutes and made it a chapter so that it would be hopefully more intelligible. And many of the provisions are certainly the same. We hope that they're clearer than the previous CS that you saw. A couple of highlights, there are a few things. One on page 3, at the very top of the page, lines 1 and 2, to address the concern that former employees or people would be terminated to avoid having to indemnify or defend them. The provision H at the top of page 3 has been added so that it makes clear that former employees are covered the same as current employees if they're sued about something that pertains to their former employment. So they will get the same protection, the same defense and indemnification, whether they've just left or have been away for a number of years from the job. It won't matter what their current status happens to be. And they will have the same obligations and the same rights as current employees. One other thing that came out as we worked with the staff this week on the bill. Again, on page 3, what is at line 16 through 18, O2OC, that's new, and that follows or says that employers who are paying the tab fully for defense and indemnification can settle a case without the employee's consent as long as they settle all the claims against the employee and don't leave the employee hanging out to dry on something. And that was an idea that came from the chair. And we certainly agree with that.
Representative Davidson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Cox, on regards to what you just said, so a settlement moves forward, but in some settlements that can still leave some questions as to the reputation of an employee, for example. And how would you handle something to make sure that the employee was satisfied that his good name was not injured as a result of the settlement?
Well, there are two things. One is the common practice of in resolving litigation in settling to include a provision that says that nothing in the settlement is an admission of guilt or responsibility, liability, whatever, so that and settlements are, of course, extremely common, and the public perception is, or at least the explanation is, that we settle when we evaluate the risk and the exposure and the possible liability and settle if it's in the best interest of the state to avoid greater risk and exposure, and also because of the cost of litigating itself. But I think another thing is involved, and that is the idea that if an employee feels that they have been maliciously attacked or maligned by the litigation, they have the opportunity to bring some kind of a counterclaim against the person who has sued them. That is possible, but it is standard practice for the state, at least, and I think even in the insurance context, for the insurer not to finance that kind of litigation. Sometimes, for instance, we'll get a police officer who says, this was by the book, and I did not assault this person, whatever. It was not excessive force, and I resent the fact that they sued me, and I want you to sue them back for malicious prosecution or abusive process. And it's certainly not the state's practice to do that. That's considered personal litigation, and that possibility is left open for the individual.
If I may continue here. Mm-hmm. So the situation you just described, it seems that a police officer would have just cause to counterclaim, yet because it was not in the financial interest of the public employer, the suit goes no further. So how are we then to ensure that in a counterclaim suit that what the state agreed to cannot be used in that suit to again create a bad situation for the person who is forced now because of the way the action went, and he was not satisfied because his good name was jeopardized? How does he protect himself?
Well, I think it is certainly possible, although I've not encountered it, but you could have a situation where the employee could strongly object to a settlement, and an agreement could be reached that the employee can go on and continue to litigate, but at his own expense. In other words, you could settle the case without, as to the state or the public entity, and not as to the individual, if that individual feels strongly they want their day in court. But it shouldn't be necessarily, at least that's the decision being made here, is whether it should be the public entity's obligation to continue to finance that defense and possibly indemnify that person down the line if it's not in the state's interest, or at least not in the judgment of the attorney representing the case, to proceed further. I think if you had a situation where the attorney representing the defendants did agree to a settlement of the entire litigation, that would not necessarily foreclose the issues that an individual defendant may have against the plaintiff, for instance, defamation or other items. That the fact that the state settled the underlying claim would not necessarily dispose of the individual's personal claims against whoever.
Well, the thing that prompts my concern, Mr. Chairman, is it seems all too often the thing that prompts resolve of a conflict is a resolution of the conflict is money, not necessarily whether one was wronged or right.
Mm-hmm. And so apparently remains a concern.
For just an observation, having been in that employee's position personally, I appreciate that, and I tried to address it, but I can't. I mean, right now, all of this, for these kinds of employees at least, is just policy. An employer, state, city, whatever, can do whatever they darn well please. Mm-hmm. To try to balance off the rights of an individual versus the rights of the employer, that's basically where we landed. And I would agree that the employer cannot, by settlement, sign away the rights of the employee to take further action on one of these other tracks if he or she wanted to.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Representative Green?
Mr. Chairman, along that same line then, that was brought up by Representative Davidson, if an employee isn't present and the litigation is completed, then all charges are dropped, but he doesn't have his day in court, and then he does decide that he wants to go after defamation or something.
Mm-hmm.
Does the absence of what he may have said in his defense, because it may not, for example, you're defending me, you may not have the same zeal to get something in the record that exonerates me. You're, as an attorney, only really interested in settling the case.
Mm-hmm.
So the record doesn't show this. Does that record then have any, would it have any adverse effect, or would it prejudice a later court on the defamation case? That's a long way around trying
right.
to...
I understand. I think I understand the question. I can't, at this time, conceive of circumstances where that would be the case. I mean, the claim that you may have against someone else, say, for defamation, would arise from certain facts, certain things that happened probably before any litigation. And so it wouldn't matter what I developed in the first lawsuit in terms of what's on the record, getting depositions taken or so on. I mean, we may take no depositions. Mm-hmm. We certainly most likely won't have even gone to trial if we decide things aren't looking good, the evidence is, and we're balancing like this and it's tipping in the wrong direction and we work out a settlement. Whatever we developed in the first case would not necessarily prejudice you. The issue is going to be what happened that has nothing to do with the lawsuit. Most likely it's a defamation or things being said in the media that aren't part of the court record, and I don't think I can't really think of circumstances where what happened in the lawsuit may prejudice your ability to bring your separate case.
If I might, the reason my mind was playing tricks on me probably, we understand that if, say, a criminal trial goes in favor of the defendant, and then he brings something back in a civil trial, there's almost or is guilty. Either way, there's almost a prejudice built because of the higher standards in the criminal case, but I guess this is civil both ways, and so that okay.
Certainly, whatever anybody says on the record can be used against them. So if we took a deposition in the case and something came out that was not helpful to your position, I mean, that's somebody testifying under oath. That's not necessarily going to be the fault of the... I mean, it's not going to matter that we settle or not. That's going to be a fact of life if somebody goes on the record and says something under oath. Whether I'm trying to settle a case or not is not going to affect the fact that they've done that to you.
Okay.
So, thank you. Certainly. I can't think of any other major changes between what was in the CS last week and this one, although certainly we reorganized the paragraphs and so on. But substantively, most of this was previously in the bill. One other thing I think I should note, just on the subject of employees being sued and not necessarily liking perhaps the fact that a case is being settled, it's certainly possible and happens all the time that the public employer is sued for the actions of an employee, but the employee is not named. And there the only defendant is the public employer, although it's what Representative Phillips did that we're all up in arms about, but we're not going to sue her. We don't need to because we got the public employer there, all, you know, with the bag. And so lots of attorneys choose not to name individual employees. They don't really have a reason unless they think her homeowner's policy or something is going to kick in some extra money. So we do have it happen certainly or at least the potential to have a case where the employer is certainly fully in control of the litigation in every sense and may determine that a settlement is needed or warranted, and the individual involved may not really like it, but we really rarely, almost never, have a situation where the employee personally objects to the outcome. I mean, they shrug their shoulders and say, oh, it's money, here we are dealing with the economics again, but so.
Okay, Representative Phillips?
Can I bring up my question?
Yes,
on the definition?
That was just what I was going to get
okay.
to next.
Uh-huh. Susan, under the definitions, mm-hmm. on page 5, mm-hmm. we have specifically stated the definition in section 2, employer or public employer, mm-hmm. to exclude, that does not include the University of Alaska Municipal School District or rural educational area. My great concern is we have set the definition for employer or public employer in this act, but say if we were dealing with a bill somewhere down the line dealing with anything, and we were looking for that definition, I can say, oh, I remember there was a definition for public employer in this bill, so come and take it. It has nothing to do with the University of Alaska or municipal courts, et cetera, et cetera. So we need to clarify this definition here only applies to this act, and that is not clear.
Okay.
It says in this chapter, but it doesn't right. state that the definition only applies in this act. And we need to words add some
is there not usually wording for the purposes of this act, the following definitions apply or something?
Well, I think you'll have to ask your legislative drafter. I think this is standard, frankly, but and I don't know that this sometimes we borrow definitions mm-hmm. that cross-reference mm-hmm. other right. statutes, but I would take, I mean, in looking at statutes, if I was looking at 3955, I would assume that this definition only applied in 3955 and not across the board. If public employer is used elsewhere, or employer for that matter, elsewhere in the statutes, usually it has its own definitional section with it.
But when it doesn't, then we go to find a definition somewhere. Somebody could pull this and they'd be wrong.
But it says. Yeah. Well, you can ask your legislative drafter if there's some way to, you know, if you yeah. want it to be tighter and say only yeah. in this chapter.
Or for purposes of this act.
Yeah. 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 I've seen that.
Right.
Well, that and that's why I
for definitions
really
for the purposes
objections.
Of this act. Mm-hmm. I think we can get Terry to.
Yeah.
It's Terry Kramer that's the.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just the only thing I remember about why, I mean, I didn't make the decision who was in or out of that definition, but the university, as I understand it, has a statutory. Indemnification
right.
provision already. I don't know about the rest of them, why they're in there or not.
Apparently they do.
The municipal school district mm-hmm. and REA.
So actually, we're just extending this to non-covered employees. Well, that's true. There are those in the middle. Many of the union contracts have it, and mm-hmm. all the teachers mm-hmm. and professors have it. But
right. this is who's left.
For mm-hmm. attorneys in the middle, they don't have it. Risk managers. Not for state
no.
employees. Okay, so if you could stand there for a second, we do have a consideration of an amendment. Do we have that available to pass out? Okay, would you please?
Carry on the phone.
Give us wording
right.
that makes it clear that these definitions apply to this act.
This act only.
You don't want to get club buzzing that.
You
yeah.
can go around and say N-O.
Well, we have to take action here to make the amendment. I mean, if
you guys would put amendment number 1 on here. And go to... page 3, line 22. We just to cover all the bases, I doubt that there's an employer around that would do this, but we had a what if. What if an employer decided that he or she or they really wanted to be obstreperous and pull a fast one on the employee to the extent that we require within this law that the employee be given written notice of the employer's intention not to provide defense. But if that notice was given 5 minutes before trial time, that employee is up the proverbial creek. Mm-hmm. So what we have suggested to overcome that outside possibility is adding that this written notice must be given within 60 days after receiving a request for legal defense from the employee or service of the summons and complaint on the employee, whichever is later. The state has 60 days within which to respond to complaint.
We actually have 40.
40.
But
yeah.
Sorry. Well, 60.
Please.
The Representative Porter and I were talking about this morning, about putting a deadline on the employer within which to decide one way or the other whether to defend or not. And I suggested that within the first couple of months of the case should be ample time for a decision to be made one way or the other. The employee's answer technically could be due within 20 days of being served. The state has 40 days to answer, and often state employees have that same amount of time to answer. So 60 days would be an outside limit. Presumably, what would happen is if there was any question of whether defense should be afforded to the employee, it would certainly be in the employer's interest to make sure that the opposing side agreed to an extension of time to file the answer, and then we could straighten out who should be representing this individual and then proceed. I only picked 60 because I know sometimes we don't get our answers filed within 40 days. We're still collecting information, and it's common to get an extension of time to sort things out. It seemed reasonable to have 2 months to figure that out at the outside. So that was the reasoning there.
Any questions about the amendment?
Well, it's probably a dumb question. This is well within the time that if some action was brought, that this person then would have plenty of time then to find other defense counsel.
Okay. Sure. Yeah, we wanted to make it at the front end of the case, certainly, and definitely if the employer was going to ultimately determine not to defend the employee, then they have the ability in the other, later in that section of the bill, to bring an action against the employer if they feel that they really are entitled to defense. And you want that to be happening pretty much at the beginning of the case so we can get that question sorted out and the costs determined.
There's no speedy trial rule for civil cases.
No. Far from it. Right. But, this shouldn't prejudice the employee. If 60 days seems, I would think, would be reasonable both ways. So.
If there's no other discussion on the amendment, I would entertain a motion to adopt.
Mr. Chairman, have we adopted the committee substitute yet?
By golly, we have not.
That's fine. That's
good move. I'm sure glad you guys keep me honest.
Adopt the committee substitute, 8LS089089X.
Had a motion to adopt the committee substitute dated 2894/89/X. Is there discussion? Objection? Seeing none, we have the committee substitute in front of us. What would be the wish with the amendment? Representative Green?
Now, does that mean that this amendment has been incorporated, or we just have adopted
this?
We need to go this route.
Move the amendment.
I move the amendment to Amendment A, as given out insertion in paragraph 39, 55030A.
Which we will call Amendment Number 1 for lack of anything else. Is there discussion? Objection? Seeing none, we have adopted Amendment Number 1, and we have in front of us CS for HB 277 as amended. Representative Phillips.
Mr. Chairman, I would propose Amendment Number 2 on page 4, line 28. Following the word definitions, period, my amendment would delete the words "in this chapter," comma, and instead put the words in "for purposes of this act," comma. And I move the amendment.
The amendment has been moved to, on line 28, page 4, delete the three words "in this chapter" and insert. Susan?
Are you referring to the amendment number 2?
Yes, to the amendment number 2.
I think it's, in my view, probably not much of a change or not a significant change. It makes it clear that these definitions apply only to this act, which would be the chapter, the bill before you, and would not extend the definitions therein to any other part of the Alaska statutes.
Which they probably didn't anyway, but this makes it clear.
Right.
But, Mr. Chairman, if I may, how does this get blended into all the other statutes? So we don't. It seems to me that we're, you know, when I get my
the works back, our good works that we do down here at the end of the year. It seems like it all kind of blends in, but you say it doesn't really change it that much, and I guess it's very clear, but I just wonder sometimes.
Representative Phillips?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Davidson, for clarification, you know, a lot of the acts have their own definitions at the end of the acts. But because this one on number two is so restrictive, I didn't want anybody else to use this definition for public employer anywhere else, because that would not be the case. Public employer could mean just the first part of it, mm-hmm. including the university and including municipal school districts and including the rural educational attendance areas in other areas in the statutes. But in this one, it means with the exception of those three issues. So that's why I wanted it very, very clear that, and other acts have their own definitions in them, but for this one, just to have it here.
Thank you. Representative Norland?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I think that this act and this chapter are one and the same. What this bill does is creates a new chapter,
right.
Chapter 55. Mm-hmm. So, but the definitions only apply to Chapter 55.
No, because we can take, you know, you look through the statute, say, I'm on another bill, and I look for the statutes through the statutes for any word that has a definition. I can pull that definition out of any other statute and use it as a basis for discussion in any other statute, unless you have a prohibition like something like this.
Well, but I'm just saying that the act and the chapter are the same thing, because that's what the act does, is it writes a new chapter, Chapter 55. And that's the only way, it's just really kind of a small point.
It is, but it really gives me a great deal of comfort if it just is very, very specific.
I tell you what, we have a neutral person here that can deal with this. Terry, welcome.
No, we'll put you on the hot spot.
No, we're on the hot spot.
We have made an amendment to this bill that we think might be a little more clear, but probably is innocuous. And that it is, if you're aware, I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but on the...
Susan has just showed me the language that you've...
Okay. Found. What do you think?
Well, let me introduce myself for the record. I'm Terry Kramer, the drafter of this bill. To be frank, sir, this is contrary to drafting procedures.
Ah.
This is not only a bill, an act. It is also intended to go into statute, where we don't have acts, we have titles and chapters and sections.
Oh, there you are, sir.
And so in anticipation of that happy day, we call this a chapter, because we are anticipating that when you find it in your blue volumes, it will be a chapter. And if we say in this act, we're implying, although it is, as I think you're all aware, a very small point, and you could go either way, we're implying it's not going to be codified. It's not going to get a statute number.
I see.
And it is. I mean, we intend it to have, because this is to be the law forevermore.
Well, let me ask you this, then. If this act becomes law and then is written in a statute within this chapter, would there be any doubt in your mind, or would there... from your perception, be any doubt in anybody's mind that they could not take a definition from this chapter and apply it to a term in some other statute?
Only if they had another statute that said they were supposed to.
Right.
Sometimes you write,
yes,
for purposes of this other piece of legislation, the definition in Title 36 applies, but you have to do that by statute.
So nowhere, in no other statute, in no other bill we write, in no other law that is codified, could anybody determine that the definition of a public employer, as you have stated in number two,
what's
nobody else can extrapolate that public employer does not include the University of Alaska Municipal School District and rural education? See, I'm real worried that...
The device you're using makes no difference legally. Whether you call it in this act or whether you call it in this chapter has no difference for your concern. And no matter which you pick, essentially, no, they can't use this definition,
okay,
whether you call it a definition in an act or in a chapter, to apply
anywhere else
to retirement stuff, mm-hmm, or whatever. Mm-hmm.
That's where my big question was.
Okay.
Because this limits the definition of public employer.
Absolutely.
And I didn't want somebody somewhere else, anywhere down the line, or in any other act, to be able to say, oh, well, we've got to exclude these things under that with that definition. So
no, they'd have to do that assertively. They'd have to write it out.
Then
somewhere.
I withdraw my amendment.
Actually, I think we need a motion to rescind.
We'll move to rescind. We didn't adopt it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we're
taking a vote.
Discussion? Yeah.
Well, then I'll just withdraw my motion.
Withdrawn without objection.
Thank you.
Terry, thank you very much for coming.
We get
Terry in here for the really important stuff. We have in front of us HB 277 as amended with only amendment number one. What is the wish of the committee?
I would move and ask that this be moved out of committee with individual recommendations. I presume there's no fiscal note.
There is not. Okay. There is. Zero.
Zero. I'm sorry.
Zero.
There
are.
Zero.
There is. There's something.
There and.
More?
There's a bunch of them. All the zeros, I'm happy to say. Is there some discussion? Objection? Thank you very much. All.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anything else that needs to come in front of the committee at this time? And I want you all to notice that it's 2:30 and we...
Yay.
Hey. Hi, golly.
We're adjourned.
All right.
That's interesting.
Good job, Chief.
I can go get one. No, I really worry about that. As strong as she is in saying it, I still worry about it.
You can go find a warm book to sit on, huh?
But you done did it, guys.
You know, they don't refer to acts. Yeah. They do in the federal laws,
right.
But they don't in
right.
the state.
Right.
I've seen for the purposes of this act.
Right, I have too.
In federal law.
In ours too, yeah.
If I'm not, I can't use.
I can't remember.
Yeah.
Committee is my...
Now where?
But well, just, we'll always have to remember this.
It, yeah.
And
that's something the reviser would probably fix anyway.
Yeah.
We're going to get a reviser's bill next week. There'll be all of these little things we did that we shouldn't have done.
I think we do revisers' bills every year, don't we?
Oops, yeah, we get.
Yeah, that's the bill to sneak in your appropriations.